So everyone, welcome back for our third episode of the series of podcast In AI We Trust? After having taken care of economic and sociological implications through our discussion-based method, we would like to now analyze the question of bias. Indeed, one of the ideas and advantages of AI seems to be that it's not biased, not like humans, right? That humans are always so biased, whereas AI is just yes or no, problem solving. But is that really the case? Can we really say that AI is less biased than a human? Stay with us to try to answer and tackle this question.
Yeah, and there is some research that, you know, that has shown that there are extraneous factors that influence judicial decisions. Like, you know, if a judge is hungry, hasn't had lunch yet, you know, that might influence how lenient they are in making a decision. And ideally, that's not something you'd want in your court decision, right?
That's pretty much something natural.
That's something natural, is uncontrollable, yes. But, you know, a robot doesn't get hungry.
One doesn't.
Smart.
Got me there.
Yeah. Good point.
Ideally you have an algorithm that, you know, can eliminate some of this human bias that is leading to some sort of inefficiency in the judicial system. So we're going to look today whether an AI really is unbiased and can eliminate those, and whether we really want a judge to be completely unbiased, if that's something that's good or something human and natural and something that's needed. So, Mari, would you like to present the case study that we're going to look at today?
Yes. In the United States, there's a very hot topic, to frame it in a way, in which there's an actual software that is used across different states across the country to predict future criminals.
This tool is supposed to serve as an aid for judges to make better educated decisions about whether certain prisoners should be allowed out on parole or not.
It's more like movies, what we've seen in science fiction, and it's...
Yeah, the Minority Report,
the
for
Minority
example.
Report movie, exactly. Yeah. And it has actually showcased various biases, in this case racial biases. The algorithm works in the following way. It's a software developed by a company which, it's important to say that this company actually does not disclose the calculations used for in the process, because it would of course be incisive in the legal process.
Yeah.
So it actually has some sort of a future crime formula, which different categories, different factors such as education level, whether the defendant has a job, or if it has property, or even a family. This is, and also different surveys, and what this conveys is a score attributed to each single defender or an accusant.
It's called like the risk score.
It's a risk assessment method, which gives each single individual a risk score, which will eventually help the judge to assess the people that they're judging.
Yeah, and so but the judges aren't really leaving the decision completely to the AI. They're just using it as some sort of an aid. But of course, you know, we can think about what it would be like if it was purely the AI making the decision. And as you mentioned, in 2016, a ProPublica investigation showed that this algorithm actually still contained certain racist tendencies or some sort of prejudice, which, you know, you wouldn't really expect, because I mean, race isn't one of the factors you mentioned, right? You talked about job, they have a job, things like this, but race, you know, you're not allowed to have that as a factor, and nonetheless, it seems to be somehow
a trend,
a relevant factor.
And why is that? Well, when you think about what the factors are that would be useful in deciding whether someone's going to likely offend again or not, we think of things like how many times have they been arrested before? Well, in the U.S., African Americans are 15 times as likely to be arrested. Another interesting factor might be, you know, are they employed? Were they employed before? Well, African Americans are much less employed than white Americans. So, you know, in this sense, even though race was not a factor, it had its way of still being included in the calculation. So even this objective classificator did have some sort of statistical discrimination. And, you know, this just goes to show that, you know, the algorithm, it's just going to reflect the social tendencies, the social prejudices that already exist within our society. It's just a mirror of our society as it already is, with all of its discriminatory behavior.
And so that's kind of what we talk about, this feedback loop, right? Because many African Americans are unfairly arrested, then people are going to be, or they're going to be not let out on parole as often by this algorithm, which means again that, you know, there's more African Americans who are in jail, which, you know, it just kind of continues this sort of feedback loop.
Yeah, that sounds like a terrible self-fulfilling prophecy, really. Like, there just seems to be no way out if it works this way.
There is vicious cycles in the process of recording crime. For example, if there is a crime in a black neighborhood, that would attract more police, which more police in that neighborhood will eventually be more crime recorded, because more police will record.
Yeah, it's not just parole, it's also policing, which is also connected to the law.
That's so true. But let me just give an insight to everyone who's listening to us. If you're very interested in this topic, it might be a good advice to listen to a TED Talk. And it's called The Dangers of Algorithmic Justice. And it was recorded by Hani Farid. Quick note for anyone who's interested in this case study we just presented.
I also highly recommend you take a look at a website from MIT's Technological Review. It's kind of like an interactive website where you can try and, you know, take a look at the functioning of the software that makes these decisions. And, you know, in a very interactive way, you can see that really when you're using this sort of data from the real world, there's a forced trade-off between keeping the error rates of, you know, falsely convicted defendants comparable between groups and races, and treating people with the same risk scores in the same way. So, you know, you have two definitions of fairness there, which both are completely defensible. And, but, you know, at the same time, they're mutually exclusive. And this is, you know, a problem that any algorithm would have. And it's also a problem that real judges have, and they have to make a decision. But what's different about a real judge is, you know, that they're transparent. They're not, you know, their decision of which type of fairness to choose isn't a well-kept trade secret. But, you know, they can be held accountable. And the article ends with a very fitting quote that, you know, says, "Whenever you turn philosophical notions of fairness into mathematical expressions, they lose their nuance, their flexibility, their malleability." Well, if this topic interested you, I highly recommend you check out those two resources.
And there's also some sort of degree of a problem here in terms of presumption of innocence, right? I mean, that's also a very important element of the rule of law, that, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty. So how can you make these sort of decisions, you know, before they even happen? Like, you know, how can you determine somebody's fate based purely on these statistics? And so, you know, when you're using these risk assessment tools, and you're determining a risk score, you know, even if it's not the decision, I mean, even the decision is still left to the judge, it's going to influence their opinion, and in this sense, you know, it really does pose this problem for a presumption of innocence.
Definitely, I agree. And this, you know, you're right, the decision isn't taken, but there is an influence. And this influence predetermines the faith of the person being judged. And if this is so biased, this leads us to a sort of totalitarian system, like the one we saw in Minority Report, the movie with Tom Cruise, where Tom Cruise, being a policeman, or a detective, or how you want to call that, experiences the fact that sometimes with the idea that something is going to happen, you arrest someone before that person commits the crime. But how can you judge and trail and eventually kill someone on the basis of a crime that was going to be committed but actually wasn't committed at all? So wouldn't this create sort of a totalitarian system where everyone is considered guilty based on some algorithm that predetermines that? Isn't that dangerous for the rule of law itself?
And it's even worse if the algorithm is in fact bias,
well,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's kind of connects to a quote we discussed in class from Casili that, you know, there's no real algorithm. It's just, you know, there's just somebody else's decision. And so what? Who else's decision? Well, it's our own society's decision. It's, you know, the algorithm is just it's just showing us more about the biases that we as humans have. It's not erasing them.
Yeah, that's pretty much why we have due process and a legal system, because that requires for proceedings to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against themselves. So in this technology, how does one cross-examine a computer program?
So like I said, it seems like they're, you know, these algorithms, they really shouldn't be completely replacing you know, the judge's decision. And in fact, there's also a study done by Dressel and Farid that shows, you know, that the risk assessment of an AI is no more accurate than, you know, just what like normal people who have little to no experience in criminal justice, you know, they're not more accurate than those people. So we really shouldn't be relying on those in any sort of way. However, like we said at the beginning, judges do have some sort of bias, which isn't desirable.
People in general believe themselves usually to be very objective, so they have this kind of bias, blind spot, as was written in the book How Judges Think. You know, it says we use introspection to acquit ourselves of accusations of bias while using realistic notions of human behavior to identify bias in others. So it's exactly this that makes it difficult for judges to identify their own biases.
So in a way, maybe these AI assistants, you know, have a way to kind of detect also those human biases and counteract them and reduce the influence of these extraneous factors like hunger or things like that, and increase the impartiality of judges.
Yes, like we could use, lawyers and judges can use this technology to prevent their own biases, but it is important also to mention that artificial intelligence technology is evolving, and there's different techniques for causal models to prevent the biases, like the demographic bias that we saw with the report. For example, there is this new technique which is called counterfactual fairness, which ensures that a model's decision are the same in a counterfactual world. For example, if the defendant is in another demographic group, if the determination is the same in the counterfactual world, then that showcases something that humans cannot do. We cannot eliminate our own implicit biases when they do a ruling.
But maybe we can conclude by saying, you know, if a judge is gonna try and use these sorts of algorithms, though, because I mean, this sort of technology that you proposed, Mario, isn't really being used in great detail yet, right?
It hasn't.
So if a judge is going to use like the artificial assistance, like we saw with in the case of parole in the U.S., you know, they still need to show some sort of independence from these. They can't be relying on them entirely. And so when the judges are guided through this decision-making process, you know, they still need to really understand those algorithms, to understand the capabilities and limitations of those algorithms, you know, through better education and you know, that's also kind of coming back to our last episode. You know, the judges who are using them, they need to understand them. They need software training. Because otherwise it becomes really dangerous. And you know, the way some of these algorithms are presented, you know, it's like very, oh, it's the latest in data collection and algorithm analysis and, you know, fancy terms that make it sound so technological and fantastic. And it seems like, you know, judges are like, oh, like, it sounds so great. Of course I should take this into account, when really, like we said, they're not really much better than the normal person. You know, the judges need to be educated in understanding the limitations and how to use them.
Yeah, and the possibilities. And I think, you know, to bring this back to philosophy as well, and to want to connect what we're going to talk about next, I think it's also important that we always remember that, in general, law in itself is something that is imperfect. Finding a way of being completely fair is always very difficult. There is always a bias. There's a bias for humans, but there's also a bias for machines, because it depends on the situation and depends on the interpretation. And just the fact of deciding what is just is already very hard. So to try and answer our question here, our founding question, our research question, which is there really space for artificial intelligence in settling legal disputes in court? What can we say here for the bias? Probably, yes, there is space for artificial intelligence, but in a very limited way, as an assistant.
As an aid,
and only insofar as everyone is trained to use that aid the best way, right?
Yeah, but if we don't, it becomes very dystopian.
Dystopian.
Yeah, and following your same stream of thought, there is a research lawyer that says that the computer is not a substitute for lawyers and judges. It is just a tool that lightens the burden. So they must be prepared, and the proper training and the proper preparation must be happening. And we're this is actually very slowly taking off.
Yeah, so again, a very interesting case study that we discussed today. I hope you enjoyed it. Next time we'll meet our interviewee, Professor Bertini, who is a professor of constitutional law, who will also be able to discuss a little bit more of the implications of, you know, what does it really mean for the legal process if it's completely automated and there's no human you know, accountability in the decision making.
And interpretation. What is the role of morality? Those are founding questions for foundational questions for what we're going to analyze. So at this point, we will meet you next time to study for our fourth podcast for the implications in legal philosophy. And take good care and see you soon.